December 1982. Almost 33 years ago. Lots of tech meds. And they're all recorded. And you can play them back. Well, the last 10 years of them are recorded at K2NJ. Semi. KC2NJI, Mike, number one, is the website at amateurradio.tangovictor. You go there and you can find the right year, the right month, the right week, and play back past TechNet. For those who can't stay up as late as this net runs, which is till midnight, a few days after the net, this recording will be there. You can download it and play it back at some convenient time. We'll also be having tonight Space Report number 210 by WS2N. We'll be having the mailbag by KC2 WGB. And along the way, we'll also occasionally have remarks from Hal K6TZ, who gives us the more brief answers. Standby. This weekend there was a flea market in New Jersey. We may hear some reports as to how that went. There was a picnic by Limark, and there also was a lighthouse event that took place at Horton's Point out on the North Fork. So maybe somebody will come forward and give us a description of those a little bit later on. One of the main things that ham radio operators would like to know about, and most electrical engineers would like to know about, would you believe that electrical engineers who specialize in RF communications, only a few percent of them come out of school thinking that they understand antennas. Only a few percent of the RF electronic engineers. So antennas are an awful big mystery. And the way it is taught in our schools, you talk to a ham radio operator who's got a small number of years of experience of tinkering with an antenna in his backyard, quite often.
Repeater, time out.
Quite often that ham radio operator will realize that an antenna is not black magic. It's not rocket science. It's a bit complicated. But still, with the experience of some apprenticeship in that subject by your fellow amateurs or the people you work with, you soon realize that you acquire a number of rules of thumb as to what you've discovered for you works and doesn't work. So we discuss an awful lot of those rules of thumb of antenna design, antenna understanding, antenna improvement. You can have the world's best transmitter, the world's best receiver. If you don't connect it to a good transmitting antenna and a good receiving antenna, you don't have RF communication. Arguably, the antenna is more important than any other component. Let me drop this. And if you look at all the subjects that we've discussed on the TechNet, antennas and things related to it, transmission lines, standing wave ratio, antenna tuners, that's probably the subject that's on the top of the list as to what's most discussed, for a darn good reason. The schools do a rather poor job of covering that material in user-friendly format, in a way that you can walk out of that room whistling that tune. A lot of requirements, a lot is required. I had a very nice 4-hour meeting this weekend, let me drop it, with K2UIH, Dr. Alan Katz, who is a professor at the College of New Jersey in Trenton, and he teaches the electrical engineering course called the Maxwell's Equations. And he and I had quite a discussion as to the method by which it's taught in our colleges versus the way it's really practiced in the field, and the way people, after 10 years of apprenticeship, the way they practice antenna engineering. Very, very different from the way it's taught in the schools. Curriculum is sort of fixed by state agencies and whatever, and a lot of modification is required, in my opinion. I've been saying this for quite a few years. What's going to happen on the TechNet tonight? Let me drop. It's very similar to almost every other night. We have an extremely loose schedule. We take check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment. They're going to give me their call letters, their name, and the word yes, meaning they do have a question or a comment. And we do that for approximately an hour or a little bit longer, depending on the questions. Of all the people that I sat down and talked with when I went to the three different field day is that John goes to the mailbag, KC2WGB. He monitors the Echo Link, the chat room, and he also unstuffs his mailbox. Let me drop it. He unstuffs his mailbox of questions he gets from people who don't yet have the right equipment, don't have the right license yet to talk to us directly. The TechNet is primarily a live show. You're hearing it as it's being composed, if you know what I mean. It's a very little bit of it's really prepared. And that's the way we do it. John and I are not offering a free written consulting service. If you have a question, come on and talk to us live and let everybody else hear it. So John chooses 2, 3, maybe even 4 of those submittals that he gets in his mailbag because the person doesn't yet have the right license or equipment to talk to us directly. The third thing in our menu is a very popular section by Paul WS2N, a space expert, and NASA and ESA, European Space Agencies and the Japanese Space Agency and the European Southern Observatory. All of these places are doing some exciting things, and Paul brings that to our attention as to the latest rocket launchings and rocket landings. I mean, who would ever believe that after using some kind of a rocket to put something in space, that you can bring the rocket back down tail first and land it and recover it right at the launch pad. Some of that's going on, so Paul will bring us up to speed on that. That gives you the general menu. It's a somewhat loose menu, but we change it from time to time. And if you've got a better menu we should be following, let us know about it. So we're about to take, let me drop the call. I'm about to check in from people who do have a question or a comment. And they're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. And try to wait for the 4 beeps, even though I sometimes don't do it. K2LAW listening.
KC2PYT, Ed, yes.
This is KC2 Queen Yankee Whiskey. Name here's Joe, and yes, Dick, you could put me last today. Put me last on the list.
Okay, we had absolutely perfect sign-ins by Ed and Joe in that order. Fantastic. Anyone else check in because you do have a question or comment? Please give me your call letters and name and the word yes at this time. K2RIW.
Hey,
Sergio,
yes.
I wonder what that guy's name is. I'll put him down as Eric. Okay. K2EJ, we got you. So once again, we've got Ed, Joe, and Eric. Anyone else? Sign in, give me your call letters and name right now.
This is Rob, KD2JMD. No questions, just love to listen.
Okay, Rob. Anyone else to check in who does have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now. One last try. Is somebody trying to sign it? Give me your call letters and name. We might have more than enough to get started. So Ed, KC2PYT, how are the electrons in your neighborhood treating you today? The electrons that fly back and forth in your antenna, that make a strong magnetic field, and that magnetic field gets launched as a wave into space, and none of those electrons leave your antenna. But still, how are those electrons treating you, Ed? KC2PYT, K2IW, check that.
Good evening, Dick. The electrons are treating me very well, and as that magnetic field flies through the ether, I'm sure someday we'll figure out exactly how it does that without an electric field. But my question today has to do with splitters and diplexers and the like. As you are aware, China is now making cheap mobile tri-band rigs that'll handle 2 meters, 220, and 440, and I find them very tempting. But one problem I have is that my wife is concerned about the concept of having a 3-foot-tall tri-band antenna on the roof of the car, and, you know, legitimately so. But I've been able to negotiate the possibility of having a second mag mount antenna that is for 220. The problem that I have now is how to connect those two antennas to the one output, the one antenna output of the radio. I know I could use a switch, but I'm sure that if I do that, eventually I'm going to forget what position the switch is and transmit on the wrong band. So I'm wondering if the TechNet has any thoughts as to the best way of connecting this up.
Particularly in the case of a multi-band transmitter, a manufacturer building such a device is strongly motivated to make sure that final stage is fairly rugged. So in the worst case, if you flip the switch to the wrong band, and by the way, with any reasonable amount of loss in the transmission line, even if you transmit on the wrong frequency into a particular antenna, the antenna is not a dead short or an open circuit. It's got some kind of a rather high standing wave ratio when you're on the wrong frequency, but it's not infinity. So some of the energy still gets radiated by the antenna. Some of it gets lost on the way to and from the antenna by way of the loss of the transmission line. Therefore, the transmitter is going to see a considerably lower standing wave ratio than the antenna is presenting. But then what I'm getting at is that a good manufacturer knows darn well that if he's built a final stage that covers more than one band, that there's a high probability periodically the transmitter is going to be connected to an antenna on the wrong band. Therefore, almost no transmitter is going to suddenly blow up because you've done that mistake. But just notice that you're not getting an answer. Or if you're watching the standing wave ratio, you've got a high standing wave ratio. So I wouldn't lose a lot of sleep about having the switch set the wrong way. Let me drop. And as time goes on, many manufacturers of final power transistors are bragging about the fact they can tolerate a dead short circuit for X number of seconds or minutes. So transistors, the final stage transistor is getting more and more rugged. We're hearing on the TechNet less and less people complaining that, hey, I had to replace the finals in my rig because they got blown up because I made this mistake. We don't hear that anymore. In the beginning, yes, 20 years ago, we don't hear that. So I wouldn't lose a lot of sleep over that. The duplexer, diplexer, multiplexer, the filter network that automatically takes the common lead out of the transmitter, automatically directs the right frequency range to the right cable, therefore to the right antenna. It's a sophisticated approach. It's got a little bit of insertion loss. In some cases, I guess that device is kind of pricey. And if you're really enthusiastic, it's possible to build that multiplexer filter assembly. It's possible. I didn't say it's easy. The actual raw materials that go in there, let me drop it. The raw materials that go into that multiplexer filter assembly are not expensive. Properly tuning it, properly shielding it, laying it out correctly, yeah, there's a little bit of art and science to that. Let me turn it over to the net. KE2EJ, I'll bet you, has run into this problem among other people. So other people who've got modern-day multi-band transmitter and a whole lot of individual antennas, there's only one output connector on the transmitter, and they want all that to come out right. How have you guys solved the problem? What has gone right? What has gone wrong for you? Anything you can tell us? Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW, the TechNet. Maybe not very many people have run into that problem yet. Let's see if I've partially answered your question as you've asked it so far. Okay, Eric, you say you've got some comments? Go right ahead, Eric.
Now, there's a couple of manufacturers that make what they do. Diplexers and triplexers. Plug-ins and the rig that I have in the car, I've got HF, I've got 2 meters and UHF, and what they call triplexers. They're not really that expensive. Make them for 2 meters, 220, 440, and I've also built my own Kayakly running a Harris, so it's not an impossible task. A little bit of that, or you could just, spend like $60 and get yourself one of these boxes. Diamond, Epson had one, a couple other big antenna manufacturers. The other solution, of course, is to use a tri-band antenna, or a two-band antenna, depending upon what band you choose. are out there. Building one is a lot of fun. It'll be a little bit frustrating when you sweep it, tune it up, but then again, that's the whole point of building something, isn't it? So RWK, good sir.
My guess is you're contemplating building one of those, but at your level of affluence, a couple of hours of labor gives you the money to just go out and buy the thing. So my guess is you might not have built one, but you've already bought one, and not to me like you're fairly pleased with the operation. All of that true, Eric Grant.
Yeah, well, the one that I built is in the house. So I went at it with the intention that I'm going to use a lot more power than what to buy. Because what to buy in terms of HF, 100 watts is it. If you want to learn any more than that, you're going to be doing it yourself. But it depends on the application. Like at the station, I have an antenna that's 2 meters, 220, 440. So I don't need anything there. I got three different radios. So I got to put them together. So in that application, I use a ready-made piece of gear. Not a problem.
Hi, Brian, Eric. So, Ed, do you have any further questions for Eric? He's been there, he's done it. And you've got any further questions of yours? KC2PYT, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No further questions. You've basically confirmed what I suspected I would end up doing, which is get a splitter and just not, or a switch and just not worry about it too much. I have looked into the buying a triplexer and then another diplexer to sort of split out the 220 transmissions and then send that off to another line and then recombine the 2 meters and 440. But that's getting to be kind of complex. I might look into building one, since now that I think about it, it's really just one bandpass filter and one notch filter. So I'll give that some thought as well. But most likely it'll just be the switch, and I'll try to be mindful when I'm transmitting. Thank you very much, and have a great night. KC2PYT.
Yeah, go over. Give us some more words on that, Eric. KE2EJ, KE2RIW.
Well, they're not lossless devices. That's what you're doing satellite. You want to be able to get as much signal as you can to it. Not transmitting, that's receiving. So insertion loss becomes a gain. If you don't care, that's another story. I don't see a problem with that. If you don't care, understand, you get a cascade to it together. You made somewhere between 1.5 to 3 dB.
Yeah, good information, Eric. Eric, you could use a little bit more audio, a little more audio volume. But I agree with you that the cascading filters gets a little bit tricky. There's a very rare kind of filters which are called constant impedance filters. It really is the equivalent of a low pass into a dummy load, a band pass through the filter, and a high pass into the dummy load. In other words, the filter has an input impedance that's 50 ohms DC to light. Constant impedance filter. Very rare item. 99% of all the filters in the world do their filtering by in the pass band, presenting 50 ohms, and passing the signal through. The reject band, the filter is almost always a perfect short circuit. Therefore, if you put the wrong frequency into the filter, it sees the filter as a short circuit and all of it gets reflected back to the transmitter. That being so, you now try to cascade a triplexer, and then one of the ports of the triplexer, you put another kind of a diplexer-like filter. And if all of those filters and all of those frequencies are not constant impedance filters, a very rare design. It's a little bit more elaborate. People are slowly discovering this. Mini-circuit is now starting to sell constant impedance filters. It was something that appeared as an article in the IEEE proceedings way back in 1967 or so. People didn't know that capability existed, but the well-kept secret is that all filters, let me drop.
Well, that's intended for cell phones, the multiple bands. You're not dealing with a lot of power with them.
That's also true. A constant impedance filter can only take a certain amount of power because there's a termination. There's got to be a real resistor termination to absorb the frequencies that are being rejected. But almost all filters that sustaining a short circuit on the input terminals of the filter at that frequency. So all the rejected signals go back to the transmitter. It's, as I said, a well-kept secret. No one ever considers what happens to the energy on the wrong frequencies that are being put through a filter. And now you start cascading filters. You're putting extra insertion loss, and the way they interact with each other can sometimes get pretty nasty. So, gotta be careful with those kind of things. Gotta do some final testing. So, the brute force approach with the lowest insertion loss and the highest reliability is a single pole, end pole switch. A multi-pole switch gives you the lowest loss, the highest power capability. Everything's hunky-dory. And if once in a while you switch it the wrong way, a modern-day transmitter is going to take it. That's the safest approach as I see it, because there's a lot of art and science required to building the right filter network at the right power level and then cascading filters. That's getting very tricky. It's a bit of a minefield there that you're slowly discovering about. And KC2PYT, good question. KQIW in the TechNet.
All right, I'll be careful if I do decide to go down that route. Laziness and frugality will probably win the day, though. Have a great night. KC2PYT.
And by comparison, Ed, your audio is a tiny bit heavy. Your audio is a little bit heavy, and Eric's audio is a little bit light. Okay, Joe wants to call it. Joe wants to put it at the end of the list, so we'll do that. Eric is going to be next. Is there someone else signing in? Who's the person who just said a couple words? KQLIW is a tech net.
Yeah, Dick, if you want, I could go now if you want. This is Joe. I could go now. KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey.
Queen Yankee Whiskey. You're number one on the runway. Go right ahead, Joe.
Hey, Roger, that. I just want to say, you guys are never boring. You're never boring. I love you guys. Love you guys. And second, I heard about, I don't know if I'm mistaken, I heard about Amateur Electronic Supply, AES. I think they're closing their doors July 27th. Okay, I think I do have a question. My question to you, Dick, is have anybody ever got their amateur radio, I guess, stolen? Let's say, like, out of their car. Like, say someone left your car there and all your amateur radio equipment is stolen out of your car. My question to you is, if you have full coverage through the insurance company, will they also cover your radio equipment too? Back to you, Dick. Back to you.
I'm reasonably sure that ARRL sells a kind of ham radio insurance and does it cover the ham radio equipment without a doubt. Would your ordinary homeowner policy or your automobile policy, will it cover the ham radio equipment? There I'm a bit doubtful, because the automobile policy, for instance, really is worried most about collisions and liabilities because your vehicle struck something. Their main motivation is to make sure that the electronics you added to the car, that's not part of the car's operation as far as the insurance company is concerned. For them to cover it, I'm kind of doubtful. But maybe I'm wrong. You guys out there?
You can get it right.
Yeah, give us some words on this, Eric. Give us the right amount of audio, take your time, and tell us about the writer and how difficult to get it, how much it costs, whatever you know. You got it, Eric.
KQRWK2 Davis, it'd be enough audio. You can get a rider to your policy, but it tends to be pricey from the auto insurance companies because auto theft is a rampant thing that happens. The best bet, really, is the ARRL insurance. Not only will it cover your radio if it gets stolen, it'll cover your radio if it blows up. If you have severe damage to it, they'll replace the radio for you. It's really good coverage. It's quite cheap. It's relatively inexpensive. I think it's something like $50. Don't quote me on it. But that's ultimately for him. That's their best bet. And it's pretty much no questions asked. So the only thing they expect is a police report when you do have something stolen out of your vehicle. K2RW, K2JR.
WGB with a comment.
John recognized. Eric, just the right amount of audio. Don, good information. I thank you. Go right ahead, John. KC2 WGB. your IW. I wonder what kind of insurance you got along these lines, John. Go ahead.
Well, the insurance companies are in business. They will definitely sell you a policy. But if you're a tenant and you have a tenant policy for theft, sometimes that is included. You just check with your insurance company. Also, if you're a homeowner and you have the personal additions with jewelry and things like that, sometimes they will protect you from things that were stolen from the car. So it always pays to check. You don't want to buy two policies. But like Eric said, the best thing with the ARRL is it covers repairs and theft. So that's probably the most economical way to deal with it. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Let me add that most homeowners' policies, you can get it to cover it, but there's usually a fairly large deductible with it.
What are we talking about here? Like a $200 deductible? Eric, go ahead.
Depends on the company and how you purchase your insurance. And the same thing goes for homeowners insurance. There's always a deductible involved with that. So it's like you pay a little bit, they pay a lot. And you can extend that coverage if you want to pay more.
Good information, you guys. So, Joe, any further questions on all of the above? KC2QYW, KQRIW.
Yeah, Roger, Roger. Thank you for all the really, really good information, and I'm all set for today. Love you guys, and thank you very much, and send it back to you, Dick.
Hey, John and Paul, sounds like we got another happy customer. We're going to have to send him a bill. That's a joke. And if we keep paying the joke, he'll keep saying those nice words. That's also a joke. I said that to a particular person who was paying me a very nice compliment at one of the field day sites. I said those words, if I keep paying you, will you keep saying such nice compliments? Well, I happened to hit a sore spot when I said that to the person because he's a very straight arrow, and even making a joke about paying for a testimony struck him as improper. You gotta be careful where you put your jokes. Eric, how are those electrons and all those high power transmitters are treating you? I guess it was yesterday we talked to you on top of Hope Mountain. I guess you were hoping for some real good propagation, and you got it. You're a long distance from New York City, and you got into the repeater, and both in the UHF links as well as the VHF links. So we've been spending quite a bit of time fixing transmitters in New York City and New Jersey these days. So how are those electrons treating you, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW, the tech man.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, my thing tonight is just a follow-up of the discussion last week. And I've made some more adjustments and gotten some rather interesting results. Just as a quick refresher, I have a full power FM station I guess it's about 30 miles away, and a very low power FM station on the exact same frequency and synchronized by GPS, right smack in the middle of Midtown Manhattan. And that transmitter is intended to cover areas which the building shadow and people cannot pick up the full power station. So anyway, my issue with the depth of modulation was that the issue that I was having when we first discussed it was that the modulation level of the low power station was a bit more than 3 dB lower in terms of modulation depth. I'm going to drop. And it sort of became a little bit annoying when you got to the fringes of the coverage, which is really rather small, whereas you could actually hear the levels of the audio pop up and down. When you're in the fringes, you get not the kind of response that you were describing. It's more like you get a little bit of distortion. Maybe that goes under the same heading. So I had made the modulation of both stations so that as you switch from one to another, you can't hear it. They're exactly the same level. And I found that the type of distortion that I was getting increased. So yesterday, maybe. The mixing effects of when you're in the fringes where you can't really decide which station is listening to becomes more clear, and the actual distortions that you hear is far less, which makes it a more acceptable situation. And actually, we've got people phoning in now saying that, wow, we can actually pick up the station where we never could before. And I've not gotten a single complaint about the fringe areas where it mixes with one another. That's just kind of the follow-up of where we're at. K2RW, K2J.
Yeah, this is a not easy to understand situation. Andy WA2CDL with the installation he was working on at one time at the MTA, and Eric is now in a similar situation where you've got two simultaneous transmitters on the exact same frequency. If they were amplitude modulated, and if the carriers were really synchronous, in other words, both operating from the same master oscillator, which in some cases is the GPS satellite, you have a so-called disciplined oscillator, which is controlling the frequency, then with amplitude modulation, two separate transmitters, you know, each covering two separate areas, so to speak, and you're midway between the two, or you're off to one side, everything's hunky-dory most of the time. In the case of FM modulation, in the case of the Andy situation, it was the PL tone, a very low-frequency tone, is sweeping the carrier of the two transmitters up and down in synchronization. However, depending on the distance you are from transmitter A versus the distance between you and transmitter B, you're getting one of those signals sooner. Therefore, the exact same modulation, the FM modulation, gets to you sooner. Let me drop this. Therefore, the phase of the audio, so to speak, on transmitter that's closer to you goes higher and faster than the one that's further away. Therefore, from your point of view, even though both of these transmitters are going to sweep to the exact same frequency, when they go to their positive peak of FM modulation versus the negative peak, they're both going to go to the exact same frequency, but one gets there sooner. Therefore, throughout that whole first half of the sine wave of audio, one carrier is higher in frequency than the other, because it got to you sooner. And then when it goes in the other direction, it's going to be it's going to be lower, again, because it gets to you sooner. So whenever you've got two carriers that are instantaneously on a different frequency, they're beating against each other. In Andy's situation, it came out as a growling sound in the audio, because your receiver is hearing two separate signals that throughout the PL tone modulation were always on a slightly different frequency, and therefore they're repeating against each other. Even though if the PL tone could be turned off, both carriers are on the exact same frequency and they wouldn't be beating against each other. Let me drop. So in the case of a PL tone, you've got a highly repetitive event, therefore you hear it as a continuous growl. In the case of the audio that Eric is talking about, there was no PL tone. It's now the ordinary audio of music and human speech, where all the frequencies are never twice the same. Therefore, you've got a much more complicated kind of two separate transmitters that to you, the receiver, at each instance seem to be on slightly different frequencies, but now we're talking about individual tones of modulation, which determine how fast the actual frequency is being swept during the FM modulation. So you hear it as distortion, and it's not a distortion you can easily pin down. It's no longer a growl. I mean, when the transmitters are sending a high-frequency note, the growl is a high-frequency difference in distortion. The growl is a high-frequency when you're transmitting audio of a high-frequency note, and the low-frequency note is going to be a growl. So the peak note you get is a function of what is the frequency and magnitude of the audio that's being reproduced at that instant of time. So you hear it as a distortion. In the most ideal world, let me drop it. There's I think it's called a Dickey limiter system, which is used on electronic countermeasures receivers. There's ways of building a limiter discriminator, which has extremely high capture ratio. In other words, if 0.3% weaker is one of the signals, after that particular limiter RF discriminator are nowhere near that high in performance. So therefore, if the two signals are close to amplitude equal because of where you're located, but because they are different in time, because you've got two different distances between you and those two transmitters, you're going to get this problem. And as you move a couple of feet, one of the signals gets stronger, the other signal gets weaker. The stronger one captures your limiter, and the problem goes away. So it's a complicated situation of the ground is not constant in frequency, and as you move the receiver, the problem comes and goes. I can see how lowering the amount of deviation of the two transmitters can make an improvement, but it's never really going to make it go away. If you're not using the full modulation capability of the transmitter, then the signal-to-noise ratio of what the customer is hearing is going to suffer a little bit. And if he's got to tune across the FM dial, and when he comes to your channel, he's got to turn the volume up a little bit louder because you've set it lower, he's going to be slightly unhappy about that. I know of no ideal fix on this one, Eric. There's no glamour fix for this one other than a super high capture ratio receiver, which is a lot more elaborate circuitry, and it's got its vulnerabilities. It gives you very poor rejection of adjacent channels if you use this very high capture ratio technique. Let me drop it. The very high capture ratio technique is more than just cascading limiters. Common sense would lead you to believe you're getting harder and harder and sharper limiting if you cascade limiters. That's not true. If you start off with a wide IF strip and limiter, followed by a bandpass filter and another limiter, followed by a more narrow bandpass filter and another limiter. You put that combination together, and I think it's called a Dickey limiter. I think it was Mr. Dickey who invented this technique. Now, when it's properly done, you get extremely high capture ratio. But that wider first stage of bandpass and limiting is going to be allowing the adjacent channel, in the case of FM broadcast, to come through. So you don't have that option per se. Over to you, Eric. And it sounds like you found a solution, but I guarantee it's not going to be perfect. I think the biggest thing was to make sure the modulation index was set properly on the New York City transmitter. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
K2RIW, KE2EJ.
Well, don't forget, what I transmit is complex. Not only is it FM, but we have a bunch of subcarriers that are being transmitted. And also something called RDS, although we don't transmit digital FM, so that doesn't become an issue. Actually, that's a simpler solution than what I'm dealing with the analog. But actually, the difference in modulation is about 3/4 dB, so to the human ear, it's barely perceptible. So I don't worry about signal noise. The area of coverage is relatively small. The idea is to cover a segment of Manhattan and a teeny little bit of Brooklyn, and because the antenna is directional, I get a little teeny bit of improvement in the area in Queens, which has a very large population, so that's why we're concerning that group. As I originally set it up, and as I calculated the distance and the propagation delay between the two transmitters, that's where you'll see the effect on the pilot and the subcarrier. It's real touchy. But once you get it in the right spot, everything stays tightly phased together. And you got to consider that my area of coverage is, in essence, maybe a circle, rather a half a circle that goes out of about 4 or 6 miles from the transmitter. So when you drive up the West Side Highway, there's a couple of spots where you hear a little bit of that distortion. The other issue that I ran into is multipath from the main transmitter and multipath from the remote transmitter, the local transmitter, simply because of the reflections coming from the building. And actually, let me let it drop. I can find some spots and turn the New York City transmitter off and get really awful multipath going on, say, right by the Empire State Building. And on the south side of it. Now, turn the transmitter on, I actually get an improvement. The multipath is still there, but it actually, because of the capture, it sounds a little better. If I turn off the transmitter in New Jersey, which is the main transmitter, I still get the multipath in that spot. It's got different characteristics because it's
they're coming from a different direction. But it's amazing what the buildings will do in terms of reflection. So, all in all, I'm really happy with it. And we've now gained a heck of a lot of listeners. And no negative responses from existing listeners. So it sounds like I'm really kind of there. Actually, the Spanish station, which used to be WLIR, did the same thing. They put, in essence, a booster transmitter on my old WNET building tower, which was on 36th and 10th Avenue. They had a lot of problems. They didn't go through it the way I did, but they were kind of happy with the results because they were picking up new listeners. So that was the name of the game. K2RIWK2J.
Whenever you turn on a transmitter and connect it to an antenna, and you and I know that if you're using a high-gain antenna like a Yagi, the signal coming there and coming out of it is a little bit like a flashlight beam. And you aim that flashlight beam at the desired target, and you think that's the only signal that's going to get there. Every antenna is transmitting some amount of signal in every possible direction. Even the directions where you think you're going to know. The know is only 20 or 30 dB down. Not an infinite number of dB down. There's still some signal there. Every antenna's got back lobes, side lobes, and so on. So therefore, every antenna you've ever used, except in free space, is going to have multiband. It's going to light up every single object in the environment. When you're going through the marble canyons of New York City, my goodness, you're getting multiband. No matter how the antenna is aimed, no matter what the antenna is, a high-gain antenna aimed from point A to point B is going to increase the ratio of a desired to multipath. There's always going to be multipath. In the case of an FM transmitter, where you're listening with your receiver somewhere in an apartment building in New York City, where you're getting a lot of bounces off the buildings, some of those signals you're getting are more delayed because it's going for more bounces. And those two signals mixing together, even on FM broadcast with a good limiter, you're going to occasionally hear some distortion. Now when you've got two separate transmitters, 30 miles apart, we'll say, let me drop them. And your receiver is located midway between the two. So you're getting both signals at the exact same period of time. And both signals have phase-locked oscillators, disciplined by a global positioning satellite receiver master signal, if you know what I mean. But one of them has a greater amount of amplitude of its FM deviation, higher deviation ratio. When there's no audio there, the two carriers are exactly equal. They're getting to you equal in time, and therefore everything sounds hunky-dory. When the modulation occurs, because one is going to go to a greater FM peak deviation compared to the other, that during the modulation, you're going to hear distortion, even though you're exactly midway between the two, simply because one has got a larger volume than the other, as far as the FM is concerned. During those peak deviations, there's a difference in frequency between the two transmitters at that instant of the peak deviation. Therefore, those two signals during that period of time are beating against each other, making what I call a growl. You won't hear it as a growl. You'll just hear it as distortion. So in your particular situation, Erica, you've had to do what you've done. Make sure that the deviations are really identical. If both of those transmitters had an exciter that was a direct digital synthesizer, where you could program the exact frequency at each nanosecond during the modulation, this problem wouldn't be there. You've got a volume control where you're setting the deviation ratio of transmitter A and then setting the deviation ratio of transmitter B. Therefore, you have to be very careful in setting them the same way. You've got to make sure that your service monitor is well calibrated when you're setting those deviations. I guess you were doing it on... Let me drop this. On a particular modulation of known amplitude, like the 19KC pilot tone, assuming that both pilot tones are set at the right amplitude, and that they're creating the exact same amount of deviation, I'm guessing you could use that as a metric to make sure that both the deviation ratios of the two transmitters are right on the money. You've got a fairly difficult problem there of alignment, as I see it, Eric. Sounds to me like you got to the bottom of it. KE2EJ, I'm broadcast engineer. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2J. Well, let's not forget that there's huge differences in signal strength. And it's where the signal is blocked
by one transmitter, rather by building these, that it's covered by another transmitter. Even if they weren't perfectly in phase, it still worked out well. But what I was able to do is I found that once I get the timing between one pilot and the other pilot perfectly in phase at a given location with each other, everything's very cool. The difference in amplitude between the two and the difference in phase as you move away from the transmitter and you go at, say, an angle that's different than the direction in which the transmitters are actually operating. When you get more than a couple of degrees of difference, you'll see the pilot decreased and there's all sorts of weird things. But given that I'm pretty cool as far as that goes, whereas I know that the amplitude of both pilots are exactly the same, just trimming down the audio level by less than a dB, it eliminates that little bit of annoying high-frequency distortion. And it's at the high end, not at the low end at all. And don't forget, I'm doing only 4 watts in one plate with essentially a unity gain antenna. Let's not get into that because, you know, Bay Raid FM broadcast antenna, the single loop, is considered to be -3 dB. I don't want to go there because that's another whole big discussion. But because of the huge difference in signal strength, except in those places where there's shadows, things work out very, very well.
Repeater, time out.
You timed up on the very last syllable, Krista. I mean, Eric, stand by. Perfect timing. Now, you've got disciplined oscillators. Therefore, you know that without modulation, both carriers are on the exact same frequency and maybe even the exact same phase. However, the 19 KC pilot tone, how is that derived? Is that a countdown from the master oscillator on both individual transmitters, the exact same countdown? That pilot tone, could it be different in phase or very slightly different in frequency depending on how it's derived? Well, what's the mechanism of deriving that 19 KC pilot tone? How coherent is that between the two transmitters, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW?
All right. There was a bunch of going to be swinging the frequency back and forth. In this case, we have two transmitters. If I put them both on the bench and set them for zero delay between the two of them, and they're both being derived from a 10 megahertz source and a 1 PPS source, okay? Those two transmitters, you could literally put them into a combiner and double the output if they were putting out exactly the same amplitude, okay? These transmitters are completely calculus from beginning to end in terms of generating its output. So, the subcarriers are derived from not only the 10 megahertz oscillator, but the phase angle is derived from the 1 PPS. Does that answer your question?
It sure does, and I was worrying unnecessarily about that one. Now, if there's any slight difference in the time delay between transmitter A getting to your receiver and transmitter B getting to your receiver, because you don't have the same number of miles or the same number of building bounces of the multipath on how each of the signals get to your receiver, any slight difference in time delay means that the modulation, the peak of modulation of one of those transmitters gets to you sooner than the other.
That affects the high frequency faster than it does the low frequency.
That's exactly where I was going. Let me drop. You're going to get a greater amount of audio phase delay in degrees on the higher frequency note of modulation. Therefore, the distortion is going to be greater on the higher frequency modulation notes. Now, I'm reasonably sure that your particular hearing has a little bit less response to high frequency notes.
That's why there's a spectrum, an audio spectrum analyzer.
That's where I was going next. Let me drop.
And the distortion meter.
Fantastic. So you got instrumentation that was looking at that as opposed to hearing it with your particular set of ears. Well done. So an audio distortion analyzer was being used. And that's a very nice instrument, which I first got acquainted with that in the early 60s, late 50s, working for Telephonics Corporation. They had a Hewlett-Packard audio distortion analyzer, and I went and looked at how that thing works. If you're setting, for instance, 1 kc of audio going into a amplifier, and you're testing the amount of total harmonic distortion, how in the world does that machine do that? It takes a reference, it looks at the amount of 1 kc audio, we'll say, coming out of your amplifier. Then it's got a very precision Wheatstone bridge notch filter assembly. It notches out the 1 kc, notches it down by 30 or 40 decibels. So the main signal you're putting through the amplifier is 1 kc. The output of the amplifier goes into the distortion meter, which notches out the 1 kc and looks at everything left over. Noise, harmonics, whatever, and rates their total RMS amplitude, or maybe even PKM. I think it's RMS amplitude. That's total harmonic distortion. The ratio of all the stuff left over versus the main 1 kc note that's there when you don't notch it out. Very nice instrument, and can give you an extremely repeatable exact answer. So something close to that is what you were using. My guess is your Synad meter also has a function that's close to that. Isn't it true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Every service monitor has just that in it. Well, the interesting aspect of it is, plus, I also have next to me, sitting next to me, an audio engineer that is out to just about 20 kilohertz. He mixes a lot of very big bands, so he's real sensitive to what's coming out there. And actually, his assessment is worth more than the instrumentation. But interestingly enough, that methodology, we also use that for testing TV transmitters, where we'll actually take a block filter that actually masks out to 6 megahertz, and then you use your spectrum analyzer, look for everything that's left over, you know, all the way up to 6 or 8 octaves above and below, to make sure that you're putting out what you should be putting out.
Yeah, when it comes to an audio circuit, like broadband telephone repeaters that used to exist, they do a kind of a noise ratio test. They put through broadband white noise, as they call it, so maybe it's pink noise, but they create a particular notch somewhere in the middle of this broadband noise, and any distortion characteristics of the total system will start creating intermodulation distortion products. And with broadband noise, there's an infinite number of ways it can be done. And it starts filling in that notch, depending on how many dB down the notch was at the sending end with the instrumentation that created that notch, versus the amount of notches left over at the other end of this audio plus RF circuit. That tells you how linear is that system. So there's some very nice ways of precisely measuring, in a way traceable to the Bureau of Standards, how much distortion does your system have. Let me drop it.
Question.
Okay, the person with the question. Give me your call letters, your name, and then proceed with your question, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Hi, Dick, this is John, KD2IXP. I used to work in the audio industry, and audio, like stereo and so on, in that industry, is measured in root mean square, RMS. But I've been discovering that audio in the ham industry, or the radio communications industry, is measured in peak envelope power, PEP. Why is that? Well, you know, what's the reason for that difference?
Yeah, in the case of the audio industry that you and I talk about, FM modulation, AM modulation, a whole bunch of subcarriers for USAC and pilot tone, stereo and whatever. Everything there is, let's call it linear. We amateurs tend to use an awful lot of single sideband. The funny thing about a single sideband transmitter is you don't speak into the microphone. In theory, you put out no power. So how do you test that? Well, you'd think, all right, I put a 1 kc note into the
each other. I'll pick a number out of the air. A 1 KC node and a 1.3 KC node. At a 300 hertz rate, because they differ at 300 cycles, 300 hertz, at a 300 hertz rate, the signals go between in phase, the two individual audios going to the mic, in phase versus out of phase. So therefore, the output of the transmitter goes from peak output when the two audio tones are in phase to almost no output when the two tones are out of phase. If your single sideband transmitter was ideal and you look at the output on a spectrum analyzer, you will see two blips on that screen and nothing else. But the way you can rate the power output of a single sideband transmitter is during the time the two tones are in phase with each other, they're producing peak power, peak envelope power. Let me drop it. So that's your reference point. If it's a 100 watt peak envelope power capable transmitter, then during the instant those two tones are in phase, your transmitter is putting out 100 watts. During the time they're out of phase, it's putting out 0 watts. So that if you look at the dynamic range, maximum power output to absolute minimum power output. And in my example, you're doing that 300 times per second, a very severe test. Whether or not there's any ripple on the power supply, whether or not there's any limiting of the final stage of the transmitter, any nonlinearity. We'll take those two tones, beat them against each other, as well as all of the harmonics of those two tones. The 1KC node is really creating a little bit of second harmonic at 2KC. The 1.3 KC node is creating a little bit of harmonic at 2.6 KC, and so on. And all those new manufactured tones are meeting against each other. So in the real world, you're going to see a whole Christmas tree of stuff on your spectrum analyzer coming out of your transmitter. Let me drop it. You're going to see the two main tones. You're going to see a whole lot of other stuff. So the way you rate the peak, the way you rate the power output of a sideband transmitter, most of the time, is peak envelope power, when those two audio tones are in phase with each other. Now you measure the amplitude of those other side lobes, those other manufactured things. And now there's a bit of a disagreement among various people as to how you do that. You rate the power of the upper extraneous signal 1 KC away. I mean, you're going to get another signal 300 hertz higher than the upper one and 300 hertz lower than the lower one. Do you take those particular tones, one high and one low, do you mix them together in voltage? Do you mix them together in power? Or do you talk about them independently? If your transmitter happens to have simultaneous amplitude and phase distortion, those two tones, even though they have a very similar process of generation, the upper tone could be stronger than the lower tone. The one that's 300 hertz high than the upper, and the one that's 300 hertz lower than the lower, they could be different in amplitude if you've got simultaneous phase distortion. So if you really want to do a thorough job, you measure the exact amount of amplitude of all of the stuff on that screen. And there's all kinds of ways of people describing what they're seeing and whether or not they think you're in spec or out of spec. So, Eric, you've probably done more of this work than I have, and my guess is the industry has come to a generally agreed upon standard as to how you set the two